pop the kettle on.
Slap on the GameCube.
Don't forget about the power glove.
And be ready to savour
the taste
of a good bit of Keno. Right then, so that was, yeah, okay, that was the intro bit done. So
yeah,
now,
we did it.
You did it. So now we can do the episode. Which, hello.
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 It's been a while because
yes,
we've had hectic schedules. So I'm sure that you can excuse us for that. Or if you can't find it in your hearts, you can just, I don't know. We don't want you here.
Exactly. We can fuck off.
Fuck off.
But after some weeks of delays, we're back and we're going to talk about nothing of quality today because it's video game movie day.
It's video game time. Most people's favorite pastime.
Exactly. Statistically, it's the most profitable form of media.
Yeah. Isn't that fun to know?
Isn't that just knowledge? Because it's knowing is half the battle, and once you know things, you can never unknow them.
You're halfway there.
Living on a prayer. So, video game movies, notoriously, never good.
Yeah.
Apart from, like, the four that are maybe okay.
Yeah. But, and those four we'll be discussing later.
We'll get
later
into
on.
Those.
Yeah. But, I feel like it's valuable to discuss why we both think video game movies as a medium just don't quite nail it. And I'm sure we agree on areas. I'm sure we disagree on some areas. But that's the fun of it. That's the fun of the podcast.
That's debate, isn't it?
Yes.
That's debate for you. Would it be safe to say that we're both gamers?
Yeah.
We're both gamer boys. We enjoy the Fortnites and the Call of Duties and all those really obscure games that people love.
Yeah.
That have like a really tiny dedicated fan base of millions.
I game quite a bit. The difference is now is that I've been doing it so long that I don't really have the same feel from it anymore. And now I'm more interested in cleaning my room, which is, you know.
You narc.
Yeah, I'm losing it. I'm becoming a middle-aged man before I was even 20.
I just don't play many modern things. I like the 90s. I like games from the 90s. That's my little sweet spot.
Yeah.
So I kind of exclusively now play games from the 90s.
I feel like the 90s has that like cozy feel where just before it all became corporate, you get
yeah.
a classic experience. You get that Donkey Kong Country. Ooh. We're talking that big. Was Grim Fandango released then?
Grim Fandango was late 90s, I think.
Yeah.
Like 95, 97.
Good shit. You have all the classics,
some Tim Schafer stuff.
Yeah, all that stuff. We're all for that.
We're all for that.
But
I like Atari 2600 games, but that's because I don't have... That's just because I'm weird.
Yeah. He's just quirky and cool like that, you know.
Quirky and cool. I like games with like four sound effects.
Yeah, it's atmospheric. It's experimental. You wouldn't get it.
It's incredibly Lynchian adventure.
Yeah.
I'd love to do a Lynchian dissection of the Atari game Adventure.
Hmm. I like an adventure game where you play as the baby from Eraserhead.
That would be fun.
Yeah,
it's not
now,
just PT.
Yeah. Oh, PT is actually an Eraserhead adaptation. Holy shit.
It is. It's just Eraserhead, but in one corridor.
Yeah. It's like walking around IKEA, but in a small house. Not just many houses.
Exactly.
Now,
so,
we've been waffling a bit. That's fine, because that's what we do here.
That's fine.
So, Yeah, the difference compared to video games is with video game movies is that the level of quality just ain't there.
No, I mean, when the highest, probably like the highest level of quality you can give a video game movie is like a set, it's like a low 7. Yeah. You know that maybe this isn't a good idea. Profitable, unfortunately, but not a good idea.
Yeah, just nothing quite reaches the heights above that. You'll never see a perfect video game movie, which is a surprise considering, as a medium, it's been around for, well, just over 30 years. Well, actually more than 30 years, probably around 40 years. And here we are, and nothing has changed.
Yeah, and I guess you could kind of say, oh, no one's figured out how to do video game movie adaptations because it is such a young, like, it's such a young form of media. But it's a young form of media that's evolved so quickly, and we have games now that are basically interactive movies.
Hmm.
Like we have the we don't have them anymore, but we had the Telltale games, and we have stuff like Until Dawn or. I'm trying to think of some other stuff that's very similar, like Life is Strange, where the David Cage stuff, Heavy Rain, Beyond Two Souls, Fahrenheit, or I think it's called like Indigo Project in other places. Yeah. Like you have games like that, which are basically interactive movies, and so like you know, you can essentially just watch those with minimal input, or even something like Uncharted, which. Like, yeah, you still have, like, you have puzzle platforming and you have shooting segments, but that game tries its best to be more cinematic and be more movie than video game.
Yeah. I think, especially when you look at the reverse end of it, the video games tend to adapt themselves and closely relate themselves with the cinematic style much more reliably than a film tries to adapt a games style. It's quite strange because you've never seen it done the opposite way very successfully.
No.
And in my opinion, that comes down to a few things. When you look at it, the way that most media is adapted, it comes down to literature. That's usually the core of it. Sometimes you'll get very specific exceptions that also work quite well, like Pink Floyd's The Wall comes to mind.
That's a narrative album being adapted into a sort of semi-narrative film.
Yeah, but with books, the thing that has to be accepted and understood when adapting a book into a work of cinema is that everything in literature is very subjective. There are qualities that are written down, obviously, and there are descriptions and there are aspects of the narrative that are core and that can be defined. But ultimately, your perception of that text, it all comes down to you. You're the receptor of that. And you ultimately create these worlds in ways that I'm sure the author would not have intended. Because that's how it works. It's the bridge between like the human perception and the work of the author. Which is very different with a film because everything is visual. It's much less... mental, it's much less psychological. You have to actually, you see it, and that is the perception of it.
But also with a book, the characters, like adapting a character in a novel to a character with an actor is incredibly easy because, you know, that character has one set of actions, has one way that they act in the novel. So the actor can just go, right, okay, I know kind of how I'm gonna, what emotions I'm gonna use to play these scenes. But with a video game, because you are like you yourself are the actor, and there are millions of people who are also actors in this video game, everyone's going to have such a different path that they take their character on.
Yeah.
Or like even in a narrative based game, like for the like I mentioned Uncharted earlier, people like the shootouts in that, everyone's going to have a unique version of that shootout where they used a unique bit of cover or a unique weapon. Or they had, I just ran and gunned it and got through it fine. Oh, I played it more strategically and picked off each person with like stealth attacks and stuff. Like you can't really accommodate for that in a movie.
Yeah. There's always a way to accommodate for how non-linear gameplay is and accept that. But you can't quite nail it in a film because it's interesting what you were saying about characters and actors and how that relates, because ultimately in a book, those are characters, it's written onto the page, but how you bring that into an actor, for instance, that's giving life to written word. It's a completely different territory, because if you think of Uncharted, like you were saying, Nathan Drake is voiced by Nolan North. That's his own perception of that character. Mm. It was written for him, in a sense, and he gave life to his way of speaking, his tone, everything in him, his mannerisms. That is essentially Nolan North's perception of him, and that doesn't only that changes when you bring it into cinema, because I'm pretty sure Tom Holland is playing Drake in the film.
Yeah, but what's confusing about the Uncharted movie is that it's a prequel to the games.
Yeah.
So it's like it's set, well, because I know in Uncharted 4 they have segments where you do play as the young Nathan Drake, and so this is kind of a continuation of those bits.
Yeah.
And every time I think about that movie, I think, who is this supposed to be for? Because people who played the Uncharted games kind of got all their fix with a young Nathan Drake in Uncharted 4.
Hmm.
And the people who have never played an Uncharted game are going to be so confused when they're going to have these characters which they just don't know. There's going to be no affection, because I can guarantee they're going to just have no real introduction to anyone. They're just gonna, the filmmakers are just gonna assume everyone knows who Nathan Drake, who Sully is, and then the movie is just gonna be a very boring Indiana Jones ripoff.
Yeah, but that's the problem. I think it's very easy for filmmakers to also make assumptions about their demographic that are blatantly incorrect, and they misjudge how the iconography of video games actually work, because they haven't been around for that long, and they aren't always particularly recognized in the public eye, given like the mix of generations that we have. So you send a mix of people into a cinema as an audience, you're going to get a very mixed response, and usually that's what you see with critics, because they themselves may not even play games, but they're judging it as a work of narrative, as a work of visual presentation. They're judging it on those merits, not necessarily as an adaptation.
Like, if you think about like the age of, like, let's say you have like a 15-year-old son, and you're 40. Your experience of video games was, I had an SNES when I was a kid, I think, and I played Mario and Tetris and shit on that. And then your 15-year-old's like, "Oh, Dad, can we go and see Warcraft? Because I really like this game series." The dad will go, "Oh, this looks like a fairly harmless like fantasy movie. I'll go and sit through that." And then they'll just be confused out of their fucking mind.
Yeah.
Because they're trying to market a property to people like this hypothetical 40-year-old who doesn't know what Warcraft is. I mean, Warcraft already, like the original trilogy of strategy RPGs, is semi-obscure already. Like, most people will know World of Warcraft, which basically has no story because it's an MMORPG.
I think it's very important to consider that it's very easy to get like wound up in the numbers of video games, of statistics, of the people that play these games, and the sheer number of people, the demographic who should recognize what these properties are.
Yeah.
And you still have to understand at the end of the day that it's very niche, because you bring those properties into a modern setting, into a setting, of real life discourse, and you realize, I'm speaking with multiple generations who may not even play games, and I could speak to them about Warcraft and they won't know what that is.
Exactly.
Yeah, many people may play like millions upon millions. It's an incredibly successful MMO. But the audience of a game is very different to the audience of a cinema goer, of someone who goes to the cinema. It's very split.
No, I'm gonna academically quote someone I never thought I would academically quote here. But YouTuber Scott the Woz made a video about, I can't remember what he was talking about, but He brought up this point about like the when they were making the classic mini consoles.
Yeah.
He brought up the point of, if you get five Nintendo fans in a room who all owned an NES or an SNES, they will most likely have played the same games. But if you get five people in a room who owned a PlayStation, they will most likely have played very vastly different games. And you can kind of apply that logic to the whole idea of video game movies, where you take something as broad as cinema and the audience for cinema. Statistically, if there are people who enjoy video games in our audience, are probably going to enjoy very different styles of video games. Yeah. There might be some overlap, but most people are not going to like are going to enjoy different styles of things. So the idea of making a solitary video game movie just seems wrong because you're playing to such a niche audience of like maybe like not even in the tens of thousands of in some cases.
Yeah. And that's what these filmmakers do when they try to adapt these works. They're really playing a gamble compared to adapting a book, because that will be rooted in a zeitgeist, a very, very common movement. You'll understand, like, for instance, Peter Jackson adapting Lord of the Rings, he obviously faced challenges, but the difference there was he wasn't the first to do it, but there was a much more liminal space for him to do that in the first place. He could really take it any way he went. With other film directors, they take very different means. They either create new worlds entirely set within the same sort of mythos or whatever and try to run with it, or they play on a much more simpler property that doesn't have as much to take from. For instance, my example that comes to this is the Super Mario Bros. Movie, which, if you think about it, when you really look to it, that film must have struggled so much in terms of production and creatively, considering the fact that at that time, Mario as a franchise was incredibly popular and taken the world by storm, but it wasn't anything that was narratively fulfilling. There wasn't anything to take from those properties that were available at the time. I think like the game that released most recently at that point had been Super Mario Bros. 2.
It would have been either 3 or World, I want to say, because Yoshi appears in that movie.
Oh, right, yeah, it would be World.
So I'm thinking it's either 3 or World.
Yeah. So the problem with that then is because those games aren't anything particularly fantastic narratively. It's all based on the gameplay. That's the Nintendo.
Yeah, those games are more like tests of skill, and then more about just having fun and learning. Yeah, and like going through like, oh, you're just facing very specific challenges without much of an overarching story.
Yeah.
So they're still arcade titles.
Yeah. And at the core of them, that's the sort of antithesis of the cinema goers' experience, because you Nintendo's brand and its statement is that they emphasize fun above anything else in their games. Cinema, you can have a fun experience, as we recognize with like massive titans such as the MCU, but the experience you get from that is completely different. It's not visceral.
Because those still have a narrative.
Yeah. So what we find with the Super Mario Bros. Movie, I believe it was released at the very end of the 80s, on the cusp of the 90s.
I want to say 1989.
Actually, 1989, yeah. It could have been. Let's actually quickly look this up. Sorry on for the
1993, so it's in the 90s.
Yeah, which is a unique place to release a film, given how there's the resurgence of sci-fi that came during the mid-80s to late 80s. And you go underground in that film and you see the setting they've created, and you realize that they've made the Mushroom Kingdom into this like hodgepodge of ideas.
They've basically made it into Los Angeles from Blade Runner.
Yeah, it's just really strange.
Or like the alternate 1980 whatever from Back to the Future 2. And it just, it's like weirdly dystopian, and it doesn't fit anything to do with those properties. Or the like, when you think of Mario, you think of almost like a sort of fantasy setting, because in those games you're literally traveling around a fantasy kingdom with so many different unique sort of environmental areas, with forests and airships and deserts and like huge underwater ocean areas, as opposed to Mega City 1 from Judge Dredd comics.
It's a very disjointed thematic setting. It doesn't really make sense, and understandably the reason that film has such a strange negative reception is because as an adaptation it doesn't succeed. Nail anything. It creates like bastardized and very sort of warped versions of characters that kids and people of those ages would have associated with, and they're just twisted. Goombas in that film aren't small little cute little mushroom
brown things. No, they're like these, they look more in line with like what you'd think a Koopa Trooper would look like in live action.
Yeah.
Because they're huge sort of scaly reptilian things.
Yeah. Frankly, they're kind of unnerving. They're very unnerving.
Oh, they're haunting, yeah, with their animatronic faces.
Yeah. And you see that process and you realize just how straining it must be to try and adapt these works, because it's not an easy experience, especially given that time frame. You know, games were just at the beginning of their lifespan, like 10 years or so, and...
Yeah. Like, and it's that like you were getting narrative games at the time, but they were mostly JRPGs, which, like, at that time, how niche an audience could you have got in the Western world than, like, it? I don't think many people were specifically buying Super Nintendos for, like, Final Fantasy VI, I think was the one that came out on there in the West.
Yeah.
Like, I don't, most people would be buying an SNES for, oh, the new Mario's on here, I'll get that.
Yeah.
That'll be that's a fun experience. That's no like real story behind it. I think what's also interesting to mention with the Super Mario Bros. Movie and with actually many video game movies going forward, the people who directed it knew nothing about the franchise. They were not fans of the games, and so they essentially won it in terms of like what they wanted to do with the universe and everything.
Yeah, you really have to. I feel like when you adapt something like this, especially when it's practically a newborn, like straight out as a medium, you have to have a passion for it, because otherwise you're wandering into territory that is potentially profitable, incredibly profitable, but you are marred by the sense that you don't actually understand any of it, and therefore the connection that you might be able to establish is going to be lost on you. It makes sense why the film is that's so disjointed to Mario Bros. Movie. It's just lost completely. The games are completely lost on those creators.
It's I feel like when you're adapting something as some I guess something as simple as the Mario as Super Mario Brothers, and you go, oh well, this is too simple. We have to put and force some kind of story on it, and
Yeah.
like not necessarily, because I don't know what the time scale is, but Mario had two animated shows, I think, by or in and around the 90s, like early 90s area.
Yeah.
So if you wanted information to pull from or like ideas that you could pull from, you have two animated shows which somewhat work and feel tonally consistent with the games. So I mean there was even I think there's even one like sort of Japanese anime pilot style thing. And you could have drawn from any of those things and gone, right, obviously there's a reason why they keep making animated adaptations of this series. Let's not do that and make it a weird Bob Hoskins vehicle where they have to go to an alternate timeline and fight dinosaur people.
Yeah. As well, I think that the what's really interesting to me is really like when I look at these films, and I will look at the film in particular, I realize that I kind of like as I like aspects of it when I consider that nowadays Mario has changed completely. That film released just before Mario's character and everything about him was revitalized when Charles Martinet like came into the role and
Yes.
used him.
Yeah.
And you know, originally Mario was like a New Yorker, and that's
From
why all the
Brooklyn.
yeah, it's Brooklyn. It was portrayed in that sort of style and that accent. But Charles Martinet went all out in making him a happy-go-lucky Italian who we know and love today, and gave a life to him and a sort of voice, even though he doesn't really speak at all, through games such as the Mario RPG series and the Superstar Saga game. Like all of that adds up to
Like a sort of defined character.
yeah.
Even for like the idle animations and stuff in like 64 or Sunshine, where you just get him like almost like talking to himself, or like, oh, you get a sense that he's, you know, he might be slightly lazy because he goes to sleep quite quickly, or you know, you get a sense that he likes pasta because he literally dreams about lasagna.
Yeah.
I mean, like, even they're stupid details, but they're it's a character. It's
Yeah.
something.
Because when you think about it, yeah, JRPGs, they were really captivating what would have essentially become the cinematic experience later on, with their story beats and their narratives and everything and the relations you have between characters. But the technology just wasn't there to bring those characters
Put it
into a
to
more
life.
realized setting,
Yeah, so
because
like one of the examples I normally look at when doing that is like Chrono Trigger, how with subsequent releases, it gets a lot more cinematic because they decide, I think from the PS1 version onwards, they animate cutscenes. They give it like a proper sort of cinematic feel.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we've talked quite a bit about like all sorts of franchises. And what's interesting is, again, with Mario, that's getting another film this time, which is another point we can come on to, which is animation in terms of adapting a video game.
Because animation is, like, I guess as a medium, animation is the thing that is closest to a video game. Video game, of course, being it's all computer graphics, so is animation. So there isn't much... there is a much less translation barrier there than there would be taking something to live action.
Yeah, and you get the fantastical settings of a game sort of brought across in that style and that method of filmmaking. And it begins to sort of make sense and work. And the difference is that the Illumination film, if it's still coming out, could potentially work, given that we've had many more years than the original Super Mario Bros. Movie had to actually establish itself with characters and with actual narrative story beats and all sorts of that stuff. And Mario's character has been defined perfectly well by Charles Martinet's performance, the technology that gave weight to his animations, his style, everything about him. It's all there waiting, but we're still not quite there because directors themselves are confused still about how to adapt these works.
Exactly.
Very recently as well.
I think there's also cases where there are some games that are entirely defined by sort of their animated counterparts. Like if you look at Pokemon, most of the personality that is now in the Pokemon series comes from its television anime. The universe and like how each creature like acts and sounds, we kind of know that a lot better because of the mountains of seasons that the TV equivalent has had.
Yeah.
And how that has essentially defined from the 90s defined every single Pokemon game going forward.
It's just a very interesting journey that you take when you look at these films and you look at animation, how it produces these effects. Because the Pokemon anime, if you look at that, what would come later would be Detective Pikachu. And if you look at the roots of that, it's a very sort of different style. And it's an example where you look at a film that actually tried to do something entirely different and actually quite brave, given the fact that it's bringing live action mixed with CGI portrayals of these characters and trying to make it all fit together in a setting that's not too dissimilar to the sort of style and the thematic sense that the Super Mario Bros. Movie was going for. Like neon lights, bright. It's very different to the sort of childlike whimsy of most game regions in the Pokemon franchise. The
Pokemon stuff.
Yeah.
I can kind of see why they chose that setting, because when you get into like games like Black and White especially, there's lots of, like, one of the selling points of Black and White was, look at our huge 3D rendered cityscapes. So I guess they can kind of, like, with this movie then go, oh yeah, we can do that style. But even as you say, there is something more thematically equivalent to the Mario Brothers movie where you see like a lot seedier, you see seedier aspects of this city. Like, there's an entire sequence where they go to like an underground fighting ring.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, okay. So there's like dog fighting in the Pokemon universe then. There's illegal gambling dog fighting. Okay, that's intriguing.
Yeah. Because sometimes you don't have to rely on adaptation and homage. You can really do your own thing, and sometimes it actually nails something.
Yeah.
And in the process that we have about adapting these works, obviously, a new adaptation will come along, which is something I kind of want to talk about with Tomb Raider, I suppose, later on. So we've talked quite a bit about the process and the inner workings and how it's a little bit more than flawed. Kevin, do you have any more words to say on that front?
I would like to say that... we're looking at this, I guess, from a very Western point of view, because... the vast majority of video game movies that are made are, of course, Western funded and Western produced. And a lot of the times, I think just because Western cinema has its own set of like permanent tropes, when Western filmmakers make those game movies, they're very much trying to pull something into those tropes. Even when they're adapting an Eastern property like Resident Evil or Monster Hunter, they're very much saying, right, we need to basically take away a lot of kind of what made it unique and ground it in a more Western cinematic style. So when you move into Eastern video game movie adaptations, like Takeshi Miike's really, really good Ace Attorney movie, or the Animal Crossing film that's quite good. I think even the Bayonetta animated film is quite good, just because those three things don't feel like they compromise. I think it's good on the state of like it doesn't compromise anything to like its connection with the original source material. It feels like it feels tonally similar. It feels like incredibly close to what it originally was.
Yeah, it's tonally similar, and it feels in a similar vein stylistically, but it also made me feel very uncomfortable.
Oh yeah, no, like, and I think that, well, I feel like that's one of those. I mean, I kind of enjoy that about the movie, that it deliberately is quite provocative, because that feels right for those games, which at the time critics were like, this feels oddly sexist. And then when they look into the reason why it was written that way, and they go, oh, okay, maybe that's more understandable.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, the Japanese understand how to adapt their own video games, because, I don't know, they fucking make them.
Yeah.
The Resident Evil animated movies feel like a Resident, like more like a Resident Evil movie, and they have aspects that you'd want in a Resident Evil film.
Yeah,
as opposed to Paul W.S. Anderson's and whoever directed like some of the middle sequels adaptations of the series.
Well, that's the thing as well. Like, when you consider a Western Eastern divide, particularly with the Resident Evil series of games, what you realize is none of those games really have a massive Japanese influence aside from like under the cover, because they're actually promoting sort of the illusory idea that the franchise is very Western in its roots, but. I mean, obviously, with its setting, it's always usually in North America, North American properties like the CIA, and international government, sort of like that. But the Japanese elements are still quite clear, especially like body horror elements in the way that they adapt certain aspects of both Western and Eastern horror tropes. But with Monster Hunter and its film, the problem was, Monster Hunter was always very clear in wearing its Eastern roots on its sleeves.
Exactly. And just,
yeah. Everything about the games is ridiculously Japanese, from like the palico creatures and like the menus and everything about that.
A lot of the monsters taking influence from Japanese folklore creatures and sort of everything like that. And also, so, quite important to note, games which generally don't have a story.
Yeah, Monster Hunter is not a franchise known for having much of a story, or any story beats at all that are remotely interesting, because the only story that actually kind of interested me was probably like both 4 and 3, and both of them are still incredibly forgettable plots, because what you're there for in those games, like Mario, is the gameplay.
You're there for you're there for the hunting and for the tracking and... like the simultaneously the really patient, reserved moments of you looking for the individual monsters, and then the fast, frenetic combat and all the strategy that comes with that.
Yeah,
you're not going there for, why am I hunting this monster? You're hunting it because you are a monster hunter.
Yeah, okay. It's literally in the title. It's that simplistic, and the developers didn't want you to misunderstand what it was going for. Exactly. But as well, when you put. Like the vibe of that game, like the feel of it, it all comes down to the gameplay and the multiplayer setting. That's what people remember about Monster Hunter. Going on massive hunts against some big fuck-off baddies who look like they could tear you like limb from limb with just a bunch of friends, or people like who might not even be your friends yet, But they will be. And, you know, you get that experience, and that's what people focus on in Monster Hunter. So,
Paul, why bother? Why put it in narrative? It's the same mentality behind, like, MMORPG raid groups, where it's like, cool, I'm here with 30 people I don't know, and we're going to go into this big fucking dungeon that's like multiple levels too high for us, but you know what? Yeah. Safety in numbers, we'll do it. We'll go for it.
Those are the experiences in MMOs that stick out to people, because they don't think about like all the plot or the divide between the allies and the orcs. Oh my god. They think, oh wow, yeah, I went on this massive raid where I was seriously underleveled with a bunch of people, yeah. I didn't know, and I had a great time.
Everyone thinks of that Leroy Jenkins moment.
Yeah.
Everyone has their own anecdote for that.
Yeah. Nothing narrative sticks out in those experiences. So it baffles me that my boy Paul came along and went, hey, yeah, I'm going to make a very Western adaptation of Monster Hunter as a film. You guys up for it? And it's like,
okay. Yeah, sure. And then you see the first screen, like promotional screenshots, and it's Mila Jokovic standing in a military jeep with like an AK-47 in a flat vest, in a flat jacket. Yeah. And it's like, oh, okay, I see. Okay, I know where this is going.
Yeah. And then you watch the trailer and you hear the, I guess, where the Guardians of the Galaxy line, and you just realize where everything went wrong. And they only had to show you 30 seconds of the film.
It's like, oh, there's nothing like particularly any, like a lot of these game movies strip the original identity of the game.
Yeah.
Like you don't get, like sometimes that works if you choose a game that has like no real defined identity anyway, or has a very simple identity.
It's not a necessity as long as you can pay homage to those elements that might be a little stringent, but you pull your own twists on it and make it work for you. Mm. There are films that have attempted to do this and failed, but still pulled something out of the rubble, which was, in my opinion, Doom's greatest success with that long-running first-person shot with Carl Urban.
See, I don't even think that's particularly good, because I watched Doom, and I got to that scene, and I thought, you know what? It doesn't feel deserved. This feels like a scene that you would have, like, that you would, you know, you'd tease throughout the movie. Like, you'd have, you'd like cut between head cam footage of the soldiers, but they don't do that. So then when you have that scene in the movie, it's like, oh right, okay, this is very sudden and weird and doesn't feel like consistent with what's been set up in the film prior.
Yeah, well that's why I'd argue it's a failure. Is still, even though it's landing the same sort of style or trying to, it's disjointed because the previous half an hour or more that you've shown us is just very different stylistically and a very different feel from the base source material that you're adapting this from, a first person shooter landmark that paved the way for the rest of first person shooters and was ultimately seminal in every aspect of it. And the people that played this game played it for the gameplay, nothing else.
Exactly. Doom, like the original three, Doom 3 kind of has a story, but Doom 1 and 2 is you're very angry that hell is coming, and you better go and vent that anger on some people that deserve it.
Yeah.
That's the story of Doom.
They stole your mini cheddars and
go
now
and
it's
get them back.
Vengeance.
And like, even in the first person scene in Doom doesn't even feel like it comes from the games, because it's, you know, if you wanted to do something that was closer in style to Doom the video game, you'd not have everything be so dynamic and, oh, look at how much it's swinging around and swaying around and stuff. You'd have something that's like this weird fixed angle. Carl Urban's literally just moving left and right constantly.
Yeah.
And everything, like the gun would be fixed to the middle of the screen. That I feel would be more rewarding, very like fan service bullshit, but more rewarding as a Doom reference.
Yeah, I mean, I think recently, like while you were saying all that, on Doom's end, I had a thought, and I thought it'd be interesting if we took a very brief interlude, and just take a look at the complete opposite end, for me. and this might go against our tagline as a podcast, but why don't we just take a look at, very briefly, games that try really hard to adapt from the movies.
Oh, I was hoping that we'd get into the old licensed game.
Yeah.
Moment, because I don't think you get many licensed games now, but oh boy, the mid-2000s.
That was the breeding ground for absolute shit.
I think there are some good examples, I think, that come out in that time. The Warriors game that no one asked for is really good.
Yeah. I'm going to count the Thing game as a good example. Oh,
yeah, the Thing. That's actually, that's quite an interesting like tactical shooter.
Yeah.
But, what else? There is a lot of garbage.
Now, the garbage I want to alert everyone to is... I've recently been having a quick marathon through the Saw films, which are garbage, with my girlfriend.
Are we talking about the two Saw games?
We're going to talk very briefly about the two Saw games.
No, I've not played these, but I have watched lots of people do playthroughs of them.
I've played these, Kevin.
Oh.
They are... They're not good. Let's just say that. So, you've been listening. I'm sure you have. You know that thing we were saying about adaptation being a little bit, you know, rocky, and sometimes you can't always nail the right bits and you struggle because you're like, hey, how do I adapt this from this and make it seem good? Well, Saw the game really tries to, and then full on like donkey flips off the Empire State Building with no idea what it's doing. It's lost like a dog in the rain because it's trying to be like, oh, wow, we can adapt the Saw franchise and put it in a visceral format with puzzles and combat. And the Konami's going to make it their next Silent Hill franchise. And it's just like, it just fell flat on its face with puzzles that are too stupid and too long. The game is practically like a Brain Age game with a Saw theme at a certain point. And then the combat is like flailing around with your arthritic limbs trying to hit something. And just, what was the point of there being combat anyway? I thought this was a series about putting people through deadly challenges. Why not just like make a WarioWare style minigame compilation of doing that? That would at least be more fun. But
as opposed to making a discount condemned Criminal Origins.
Yeah. And the second game
is even worse.
Is even worse. Because they looked at what the first game did kind of well and went, nah, that's not good enough. That's not good enough. So they made the combat system even worse than it already was.
Fuck's sake.
And the only thing that's kind of all right in these games is the narrative, which is sometimes kind of fine in the first three Saw films. But past that, why do you even bother?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like the people who made the Saw games never even saw a Saw movie past the first one.
No. They just went, oh, the bathroom scene. Yeah, bathroom. We're going to make a bathroom. We'll put the funny man's voice in. It'll sell it. You have 10 minutes. You have 10 minutes until the trap goes off. Like, shit like that. And just threw shit at a wall and assume it would work.
And it's, I mean, I'm trying to think of sort of bad video game adaptations that I'm trying to think of. Because the video game adaptations of movies that I've played I generally pick the pretty decent, okay ones. I've not really played many bad ones, except for, this isn't a movie, but this is a TV show. The Sopranos, Road to Respect. Someone who has never really, I've never really watched The Sopranos. I've seen like the odd episode. So, and I got this, I think I bought this game secondhand and just thinking it was a gangster criminal game. And, oh my god, I've never played a game before where, like, oh yeah, all the enemies would, like, naturally attack you at once, but they wouldn't fucking stun-lock you so that you can't do anything. And then you have combos called, like, the Sneaky Rat Bastard. I mean, they got the entire, like, most of the surviving, like, I say surviving, this was made during the time where the TV show was being made. They got most of the cast, including James Gandolfini, to come in and do lines and stuff. So it simultaneously feels authentic to the world. but fucking awful to play.
Yeah.
It's the best worst episode of The Sopranos.
I feel like on the opposite spectrum of like good would be in a similar vein would be like The Godfather.
Oh god, yeah, The Godfather's had like 4 video games.
Well, the first game was like trying to model itself as a GTA sort of clone, and actually, really, it was pretty good.
Oh.
But yeah, as you can see, or as you can hear, because this is not a visual format like a book. Yeah, basically, games as movies don't work, and movies as games also don't work 100% of the time. It's like cooking a good curry on paper and just adding too much turmeric and just seeing it fall to pieces.
Absolutely destroying it.
A car crash of ingredients.
There you go. But that's not to say that there aren't video game movies that work, because there are some that kind of get it right, just about.
Yeah. So, We're quite close to finishing off, I believe. But we've got another thing to go after this, and you're going to love it. But we're going to talk about, the video game movies we kind of liked. I'm not sure if Cameron wants to go first. I'm easy.
I'll go first because my two are kind of like, I don't have much to, like, not much to say about one of these. So I may as well get the quick one out. Done and dusted. So I think a video game movie that works quite well is 2014's Need for Speed. Need for Speed as a game series, it has this kind of vague personality of being, oh yeah, we're like edgy mid-2000s street racers. We've got a bit of snark. There's like a bit of a snarky, anarchic sense of humor to it, but it's like generally a fairly cut and dry racing franchise. So, how do you adapt this into a film? Very easy. You make a Fast and the Furious movie in a year where there wasn't a Fast and Furious movie, so you can bank on people who wanted to see a Fast and the Furious movie would come and watch Need for Speed. And like it kind of adapts, and it adapts the vague story of one of the games, like very, very vaguely, but it just. It's stylistically, it works really, really well. And you have these really well-performed, practically done stunts. Like, they use real cars, there's no CGI. They just really lean into it. There's a really great sequence where they catch a car with a helicopter just as it goes off a cliff. There's a great scene, I think, set in Detroit, where they go to pick up a character played by Rami Malek. Aaron Paul is pretty serviceable in this movie. So is Dominic Cooper and Michael Keaton are both quite good in this. And like what they do with car-based stunts is generally really well choreographed and really good second unit direction. Everything else surrounding that is a really boring crime film. But when it gets to the car shit and when it's doing fun stunts, the movie feels like Need for Speed. In the words of sort of video game journalists, it makes you feel like Batman, only it's Need for Speed.
Makes you feel like Carman.
It makes you feel like Carman.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, it's like, and it's, yeah, is it overly long? Yes, it's far too long for what it is. But when it's doing what it does best, it does it really well. And you kind of get absorbed into all the driving and shit.
That's just beautiful to hear that we finally found something good to say.
There you go. It's still like a solid 5 out of 10, but it's a fun 5 out of 10.
Yeah. It's a 5 out of 10 that will leave you feeling empty, but less empty than the others.
Yeah.
So for my end, I don't think these films are good. I think they're average. I think they're very mediocre. But that visually, in the same way, style as Cabin, they're all right. You know, I don't really have much to fault with. A lot of the support in these films comes from their budget, which are pretty, you know, high compared to the rest of the films on this on our list of films that you probably shouldn't watch. But my two picks would be Prince of Persia: The Sands of Time with Jake Gyllenhaal, and the most recent Tomb Raider adaptation with Alicia Vikander. Pretty sure I'm pronouncing that right.
Yeah, Vikander.
Yeah. So on the Prince of Persia front, I'd say that the reason this film works is that already the Sands of Time's plot was pretty simple to adapt. It had story beats that just made sense and that linked together, and that there were sympathetic moments throughout. But it was clear that a film wouldn't have to rely too much on them, and it could ultimately come out from the tunnel and still kind of passably make its own sort of storyline up. So the elements were there, and the plot itself is not great, but everything kind of links together in a way that's sensible and isn't sort of construed by very sort of frustrating stylistic elements, because visually the film is all right. You know, it has the backbone that it needs. And there are elements of the parkour, the setting, the combat system that I always kind of felt was underrated in Prince of Persia, that really come out in this film, and in the choreography and Jake Gyllenhaal's performance. You know, Yuri Lowenthal is the prince day in, day out. It's the same issue that we were talking about with Nolan North. Like, how do you adapt that character and bring it into a cinematic setting? But, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal does a pretty good job given what he's being presented with. And ultimately, he passes. You know, he comes out with flying colours.
I've never really played a Prince of Persia game, but like aesthetically, I think the film captures that universe really well. Like the game and the films look like they look like they would be one and twins of each other in terms of like visual style.
Yeah.
I think another video game adaptation that works for me is Silent Hill, the first one. It does have a sequel, and I think it might be one of the few video game movies that we've talked about that does have that has sequels. The sequel was made in 3D and is terrible. But the first one, Silent Hill, is actually quite good, and like it's a very effective atmospheric horror movie that feels. I mean, first off, it was made by someone who actually likes the games and was a really big fan of the games. And I think I read an interview with him, and he was saying that he didn't want to adapt the plot of any of the games, but he wanted to take the core atmospheric elements because those are what he knew he could translate into a film. And yeah, he does have to do the bullshit thing of cramming in, oh, I have to cram in some Silent Hill iconography. So here's Pyramid Head. Here's the nurses. Yeah, they don't have the symbolic meaning that they had in Silent Hill 2 and 3. But, you know, that they used effectively, and they're still kind of scary, and the plot feels consistent with what would have been in a game. The body horror stuff's really well done as well, even if it is CG. Like, it's scary, and it's good body horror, and it feels like it's not... it feels still like how you would have like a Japanese body horror movie. It feels very tonally similar to that. And they capture the look of Silent Hill both in its horrible, rusty hell form and its terrible PS1 draw graphics fog mode.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think Silent Hill for me is probably the one that if I had to isolate any video game movie from the West that is the one that works the best, I would choose Silent Hill. It feels the most like an actual fucking movie, and as a homage to the games.
Wow, that's good. Mm. That is good to know. You know, I'm considering watching that. I've always been a fan of Silent Hill franchise, even four.
I think 4 has its moments.
Yeah. It's the room itself is actually very unsettling to me, but everything else kind of like falls apart in my opinion. What you were saying about like being a successful homage to elements from like most of the games in particular, like the first three, that actually reminded me again of Sands of Time in that it's not really incorporating purely elements from Sands of Time alone. It also incorporates elements from both of its two sequels later on, Two Thrones and Warrior Within. And usually these are just to like lend towards like really impressive like visual scenes of you know, the parkour and like combat and stuff like that, action scenes, you know, big action, that's its focus. So I remember the dagger tail, I'm pretty sure, which was the weapon used by the Dark Prince in Two Thrones, made an appearance. Is a weapon used by some rando, I'm pretty sure. If not, it was basically the same sort of style weapon. And as well, the costume design visually is completely dissimilar to the original character in Sands of Time. You know, focusing more on like jade blue and not jade blue, like a royal blue sort of waistcoat and sort of stuff like that for the prince in that game. Jake Gyllenhaal's prince looks very similar to like Warrior Within and Two Thrones style. He's very sort of rugged. It's as if he's much more mature and advanced in his skills compared to the original prince, who was kind of similar to Mario in that he's happy-go-lucky and just kind of makes quips at any point.
Kind of almost Disney's Aladdin kind of characterization.
Yeah, yeah.
He's quite quippy.
Yeah, that was the thing. I remember I was obsessed with Aladdin as a kid, and I looked up games that were as a really small kid. So I was trying to find a good Aladdin game, and I was like, 2D graphics on SNES. I'm not playing that.
Cause was yuck.
But Prince of Persia: Sands of Time always stuck out to me, and I always wanted to play it. I played it, and it's now one of my favorite games of all time because it feels like that sort of Arabian Nights feel. It's got that Arabian Nights feel, but it captures the violence and the maturity of the game pretty well as well. There are sympathetic moments in that game and the film that really work.
I just feel like they made a mistake casting Jake Gyllenhaal, as decent as he is in the role. But Jake Gyllenhaal's from like, I don't think he's from like, I don't know where he's from in America, but he's definitely not from anywhere Arabic. I know that for one.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe
they should have used like an actual Middle Eastern actor. But like he does an okay job with what he's got.
Yeah, again, that's another problem with trying to appeal to a Western audience, because you've got to
get a big star.
Yeah, and Jake Gyllenhaal was probably the only guy who kind of like slightly resembled the prince, but obviously his background is completely different.
Yeah,
so that was likely a small controversy at the time of release. The other film I wanted to talk about is Tomb Raider. And what I think is interesting to consider is that there'd already been a Tomb Raider series that was adapted.
With Angelina Jolie.
Yeah. Which wasn't good. Wasn't good at all. And it had Daniel Craig in, and he claimed in an interview that it was the greatest mistake of his career.
I mean, between that and him saying that he hates playing James Bond, I mean, he's not made the best career decisions.
No, but he was in Knives Out, so we'll give him a pass.
That's true. We'll give him that with his weird accent.
Yeah. Yeah, his accent is... That's irrelevant, but his accent is weird. Yeah, I think that when you look at the adaptation of the style that the Angelina Jolie film goes for, it's very, very, very action-based. Very out there. And in my opinion, that's not really something that kind of works for Tomb Raider.
No.
I feel like that's what I'll get onto later as to why the Alicia Vikander film works. But if you think original Tomb Raider, I kind of think atmosphere and kind of being lost and trapped in a very distant world and civilization that's completely atypical to one's own. And the combat in that and the gameplay itself is there, and there's platforming and there's puzzles and stuff like that, but it's PS1, so it didn't always work, and it didn't always pull itself together quite well.
No, I think stylistically, if you're going to make a Tomb Raider movie, like of course you're probably going to want to borrow from stuff like Indiana Jones, because every adventure movie does, but a Tomb Raider movie that's, I think, mostly in tonally similar to something like Temple of Doom is probably would work best. Like, it still has the slightly campy aspects, but Temple of Doom is the one that has the most like sort of dread aspects to it, the most overarching sense of horror and atmosphere, which a Tomb Raider movie probably needs most.
Yeah, I think that Temple Doom is controversially actually my favorite film in that franchise.
Okay.
I know people, everyone loves Raiders, but...
I mean, I'm a Last Crusade kind of guy.
Ooh, interesting. Controversial. Hot takes here. Only hot takes on A Good Bit of Kino.
There you go. Only the hottest of takes.
But yeah, I think Temple of Doom's atmosphere as a film is brilliant. And it sticks with me far more than the rest of the films in that franchise, especially Crystal Skull, for obvious reasons. I think that kind of feel was something that they could have captured in Angelina Jolie's adaptation. But unfortunately, what we actually got was just really early 2000s action scenes.
Because Mission Impossible 2 had just come out, and everyone was like, oh, John Woo made a lot of money with that film.
Yeah.
Let's do a John Woo action scene.
Tim, let's get the slow motion for this scene, please. I want 50% slow motion. Right, there we go. We get a lot of jump cuts as well, please. It really needs to feel like it's a completely... It needs to feel like you're watching shit, like shit on a wall that you can't properly see.
Can we have Angelina Jolie fight a giant robot?
Can we
have that? Oh, we can have that because we have mid-2000s CGI budget.
Yeah, let's
play. Okay, then we'll have Lara Croft fight a big robot.
Yeah.
Has she ever fought a robot in any of the games? No, she famously fights dinosaurs.
Yeah.
I haven't fought a fucking robot, no. Have the robot.
John, the kids want robots. Just put the robot in. You know, it's good action. It's bloody good action.
Should we make it a hologram training software? Yeah, make it a hologram training software. Let's do that.
She had that in the games, right, John? You played them. No, I've never played them.
Croftman is technologically advanced, isn't it? No, it's like an old English mansion. Put a robot in there. Put a hologram robot in there.
Yeah. Hang on, John. Are you telling me that all the other people on the crew didn't actually play these games? Well, that's a surprise.
That's a very big surprise.
Yeah. So that kind of feels like what would actually have happened in terms of the production of that film. But the Wakanda version is actually borrowing elements from Tomb Raider's reboot.
Is that the 2013 one?
Yeah, which was much more visceral, and although it was kind of atmospheric, was based entirely on its gameplay, which felt like a very strong blend between Uncharted and something kind of like, a mix between the Arkham games and Gears of War and its like third-person shooter elements. Well, it's third-person action anyway. I know Arkham's like a stretch, but that's kind of the feel I got from it. But Uncharted was its key focus. And that actually kind of works in a film setting. It's not perfect, and I don't think Wakanda's portrayal is as good as it could have been. But then again, you know, there's already been a pre-existing portrayal of that Lara, and it was the game. So you had to really sort of work with what you had. But visually, again, it's good. There's the plane sequence that I remember that was quite tense. Nothing like that's going to stand out as all the Watch Mojo's top greatest action
sequences, but stuff that feels like evocative from that game.
Yeah, you know, like it would speak to, and in what's interesting with both Sands of Time and Tomb Raider is that it would speak to two different demographics at the same time, because visually. Obviously, the elements of the gameplay that stuck out to the people who played those games will resonate, but you also have the same sort of action that people go to the cinema for. So it blends those two elements together, and it works for people. The obvious con with this is that the film is very poorly paced, and its narrative is just really, it's like being led along through like Disneyland. And it's just really, really poor, in my opinion, the narrative. But they tried something. You know, they really tried. And visually, you could do worse. That's the motto with these films. You could do worse.
Exactly. Speaking of maybe doing better than these, hypothetically, if you were to make a video game movie, what would you sort of... want to adapt yourself?
Ooh. Well, this is a that would this be a good question to finish on?
I think this would be good, and it would be ending somewhat optimistically, wouldn't it? Ending on a lighter note than saying, "Oh, they're all shit."
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. See, I always felt like you could really do a good film adaptation of the first two BioShocks, but it would have to be very precise.
Mm.
I love those games. Okay, well, I like BioShock 1 and I love BioShock 2, which is a hot take. But
that is a very hot take. That's scorching hot. Because most people dismiss BioShock 2 as being like, oh, the story's okay, but it's more action-y. Where BioShock 1's like the more ponderous philosophical one.
Well, I think there's elements that work better in BioShock 2, actually. And BioShock 1 just frustrated me because its mechanics weren't quite there and its gunplay was completely unrewarding because you realize that the wrench you get at the beginning of the game is the best weapon in the game. So, yeah. But with BioShock 2, gameplay-wise, it was, you know, it was much more impactful, and everything about the playing as a big daddy was what I wanted. And the atmosphere was similarly, you know, it didn't really go too far with the atmosphere, but there was something about it that stuck out to me, more than just like increasing enemy variety, which BioShock 1 lacked. But that's what sticks out to people in these games, the atmosphere, the mood of Rapture, a city lost under the sea. And it's something that you could potentially, you know, capitalize on. I like to jokingly think that the Disney adaptation of the Disney Atlantis is actually BioShock.
It's the best. It is the best BioShock movie we've had.
The best BioShock movie we've ever had. But again, what's interesting is you don't have to just adapt a single game. If there's a series, you can adapt elements from those two works. And I feel if you mixed the process of both BioShock 2 and BioShock 1, but made it its own thing, maybe its own narrative, something that which felt lacking to me in BioShock 1 was how liminal it was, and that was, it's suspenseful, but it didn't have any weight in the end because I wanted more characterization. If you could make a film that sort of did that, if you could present the visual elements as moodily and as depressingly as so scummily they are depicted, you know, it's a very depraved world, Rapture. If you could present that, but also give the narrative elements that were missing in both those two games that weren't there for me, I feel like you could potentially make a very successful adaptation.
You know, I think that could, like, very much, yeah, I think you could very much work those two games quite easily. My ideas are very different because I'm not, like, I have a couple. One's kind of more formed than the other, but they both come from games that basically don't have a story or a defined story. Number one, and this is the wacky one that you might need to hear me out on, this is Guitar Hero.
Okay.
Because you basically make This Is Spinal Tap, but you do it with the more kind of 2000s style of humor that the Guitar Hero games had, and that more kind of like more directly sort of heavy metal influence. And yeah, you can use like songs that were famously featured in the games. Have the final set piece be fucking Through the Fire and the Flames. And, you know, and really lean into making it a kind of comedy mockumentary about a terrible rock band who exclusively does covers.
Honestly, I'm kind of siding with you now because this sounds pretty cool.
See, you can make that work. Or my other option is an anthology movie based on the properties of From Software.
Ooh.
And you have three 45-minute, half-an-hour films based on Sekiro, Dark Souls, and Bloodborne. And you use maybe a director like Robert Eggers for the Bloodborne segment, since I feel like he's more suited to kind of that style of horror, that more sort of creeping Lovecraftian-esque style. Well, use someone like David Lowry. Like The Witch as well.
Like I was thinking, because his style, with The Witch and The Lighthouse, he promoted a style of horror that was much more like based on scenery and visually. It wasn't anything jump scary. It wasn't based on anything being, oh, wow, big scary monster, which does happen in Bloodborne. But I feel
Eggers, I feel like, is the type of guy who could very effectively build up to the giant monster. And the thing is, with the nature of some of Bloodborne's giant monsters, is you can still make them quite subdued and quiet and, you know, creepy in that sense.
Yeah.
Like, for his 45-minute segment, you could build up to, like, I'm trying to think of, like, a good example of a boss that kind of doesn't need any particular narrative weight. Like, you could kind of build up to the ending being something like Abritas.
Yeah.
I think Abritas is one of the more visually interesting Bloodborne bosses.
And you could, I feel like narratively there's a lot to capture compared to other video games, because it's there in the waiting, and with different games, obviously, the narrative is all there, but with Bloodborne, you have to kind of find it.
Exactly.
So that experience would be different for different demographics, but what you could do with visually with a Bloodborne adaptation, I feel like the Rom, the spider.
Yeah, Rom would be an interesting one to kind of do.
Yeah.
Just because of like, the nature of its arena and how you access it and everything.
Hmm.
But, you know, like, Eggers would, I think, really suit the visual storytelling of the Bloodborne thing. And then for Dark Souls, someone like maybe David Lowry, I think, might work.
Hmm.
And I'm basing that mostly on what I've seen of his Gawain and the Green Knight adaptation that he's doing.
Yeah.
And, like, I was thinking, okay, like kind of visually, you could do some... He can work with that grungier style of fantasy world, that sort of darker, more decrepit, like, hopelessness of it all.
Mm.
And I feel like if you were going to aesthetically choose from any of the Dark Souls games, you'd go for 3 or 1.
Yeah.
And I can see him choosing 1, maybe, over 3.
Yeah.
And then Sekiro, I'm trying to think of like some modern Eastern filmmakers that I quite like. I could see Takeshi Miike doing something good, or Takeshi Kitano, maybe.
Hmm.
Trying to think of ones that are like still working or still. I know Miike is still working, and like basing on stuff that I've seen of him recently, like Blade of the Immortal. I think he could really do something interesting.
Yeah.
With a Sekiro, like, short.
Mm.
Just do it. Guitar Hero is more marketable, though, of those two.
Definitely.
Definitely able to market Guitar Hero more than From Software Presents.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think we're kind of...
Done what we need to do.
Done what we need to do. I think we kind of got our points across there.
Video game movies are awful, and we have better ideas than big studios.
Yeah. At the end of the day, if you want to make one of these disasters, make sure you actually play the thing.
Yeah. Be like, I can't remember his name, but the guy who directed Kong Skull Island, who is making the Metal Gear movie. Be like him, because he fucking loves Metal Gear.
Yeah.
And like he said something like that he was basically like constantly playing the game while writing the movie.
Mm.
I can't know if I read or heard that from someone, but you know, it's good to have a constant reminder of what it is you're adapting there.
Yeah, it's good to just know what you're doing, you know.
Yeah.
You know, guys,
it's wise.
Yeah. And also, don't be too outlandish.
No.
If you have to be, if the source material that isn't just right for you, and you have to make up your own shit, be careful. Get a good screenplay.
If you're Michael Bay and you really want to adapt Katamari Damacy, think about it before you start doing it.
Yeah.
Think about it. Also, try and think and choose a game that actually would work narratively and isn't just like an arcade title like Rampage.
Yeah, because that was not good.
No.
But yeah, I think we're all done. I think that's been another good return for us. It's been a while, but
had the technical issues have been prevailing.
Yes. A lot of busy time for me, busy time for Cavan. But we did it.
We got it done. We got it in.
Yeah.
What's the next episode going to be about? Want to make that up on the spot?
I was kind of interested in I was thinking maybe something on the lines of horror. I had a draw to the kind of visual style of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre recently. I was kind of thinking, like, its emphasis on not portraying gore or anything like that in comparison to its sequel was kind of an interesting idea.
Yeah.
On the opposite end, we could also start doing our director series where we look individually at directors. Maybe go out on a bang and start with David Lynch.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that would be a good one to start with.
Yeah. But obviously the people listening right now will not know until the next episode comes out.
So. That's true, because we've given them two possibilities. Now they can think about it.
Tingling with anticipation.
Yeah. So that was today's episode.
Yes, a return to form.
A return to form. We hope you enjoyed.
Yeah, we really do. We enjoyed doing this as a hobby, and we just like pushing these out. I know we have a schedule, and sometimes it's not perfect, but life ain't easy.
Life is difficult.
Yeah, again, we have socials. I know people don't really use them, but every now and then someone pops up.
This is you on the internet, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, wow. You're on the internet? Oh, yeah.
Wow. It's you off the internet.
Oh, mate. I've never seen you before. Wow. You're on the internet.
You're really cool on that, and you're on the internet.
Do you use MySpace?
Tom from MySpace.
Yeah. Instagram, Twitter, we got it all.
We got the usuals. Not all of it. The two. Should I make a LinkedIn for a laugh? No. Upload my CV to my LinkedIn, please.
So, what job have you got, Cavan? I do podcasts.
You do? Yeah, I'm funny radio man.
Funny radio man.
I am the radio head.
Yeah. Oh well, thanks for joining us again. It's been great.
It's been a good time. Yeah. A good time was had by all.
Much better than episode 4, which was you know.
Episode 4 was fun mostly because it was just ragging on a piece of shit movie.
Yeah, and we like ragging on pieces of shit, as you know.
We do.
Yeah. So thanks for listening again. And this has been James.
And this has been Cavan.
Yeah. And we are a good bit keen now.
We are.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.